All right. So tonight is the first of a two-part series about basically the structure, the foundations of Buddhist community and practice, and what nurtures that and what diminishes it. So tonight I'd like to talk about some of the historic foundations. And this is a topic which, if some of you know, I mean, we could do a year of Thursday nights on it, so deep. So I'm going to, and I don't know how long this is, so I'm going to be kind of checking myself as we go along. But, you know, I think this topic is important and timely, particularly for this group, because I think we can learn a great deal by looking at the historic structure and some of the choices that were made. So tonight I'm just going to highlight a series of things that I think are important. It's an overview, so it's clear I'm not making any attempt to, you know, hit all the topics or go in depth. But there are a number of things that I want to emphasize, including some of the teaching methods that were used to bring along new nuns and monks. There's something we can learn from that. A different understanding of Dana than you may be familiar with, and a number of other items. So, you know, when things first started, you know, the original community, the original Buddhist community was the historical Buddha and five other practitioners. The five other practitioners that he had been practicing with in what they called shamana, the shamana tradition, which was basically a wandering shaman tradition. And after the Buddha's awakening, outside of Benares in Sarnath, you know, in the texts, they always refer to Benares, and where he actually met up with them is what we now call Sarnath, at a large park there, which is now the Deer Park. And so at first they rejected him, and then subsequently they accepted him, and they became the first community, and then that community expanded to 40 people. And the Buddha worked with them, and those 40 people were sent out to spread the Dharma. And then over the next 45 years, there were a whole series of different Buddhist communities at different locations, all led by the historical Buddha, some relatively small communities, many of them in the hundreds of monks and nuns, and several of them in the thousands of monks and nuns. And so, and that model has been pretty well road tested, you know, for 2,500 years in terms of sustainability. So I'd like to look at some of the basic pieces of that. And I think it's important as just a basic starting place to acknowledge what the Dharma, or what the Buddha Dharma, you know, we're actually talking about Buddha Dharma. You know, all kinds of other spiritual traditions talk about Dharma, and we're actually talking about Buddha Dharma. And I think it's important to acknowledge that the Buddha Dharma is not something that the historical Buddha created. He was very clear. The analogy that he used is that he came upon an ancient city that had been overgrown. And he only found this, the analogy is, by going through a dense jungle. And historically, in terms of his teaching and, you know, Buddhist teachings, is that the purpose of this particular historical Buddha, and that if you believe the Buddhist lineage where there were Buddhists before him, the purpose of the Buddha is to discover or rediscover what is already there. and is already available to all of us. Now, it's pretty clear that the Buddha had this extraordinary ability to describe what was already there. But it's not something that he made up. It's not a theory. And he was also very clear about that, that what he was teaching was not a theory or a philosophy, that it was a description of reality and then a specific set of tools to help us diminish our suffering, to help us live a better life, to have a more satisfying life in terms of purpose and relationships, and most importantly, to awaken. That was the end game. Okay. So for me, this is kind of one of the really exciting aspects of Buddhist practice, is that what we're actually looking for is not only already here and already present, it's already present inside of us. So that's the starting place of understanding, I think, everything that follows, because the Buddha, as we know, went on this very intense period of practice, and at the end of 7 years had a night of awakening, and he then enunciated that, described that as three specific trainings in ethics and meditation and in wisdom and effort. And then, you know, in an eightfold path, within each one of those there are specific things, and also a causation dependent origination and a number of other things, but that forms the basis of everything that follows. So you've got these two fundamental pillars. You've got something that already exists, and then a description of how it exists in a way that is lucid and available and welcoming and understandable. Okay. And then the third piece, and I know people are already saying, okay, so when's it going to get to the foundations that he was talking about? So the third clarification before I start is... the meaning of community, okay? Because we know that the historical Buddha, refused to appoint anyone as his immediate successor. And there's reasons that he did that, but he did that, and then many of us are familiar with this interchange between Ananda and the Buddha, and Ananda says, the short version is that Ananda says, well, half of the spiritual life is spiritual friendship. And the Buddha says, I think more accurate interpretation of what the Buddha says is, no, Ananda, you got it wrong. That's not it. It's more than half of the spiritual life. Now, you frequently hear the interpretation, it's all of the spiritual life, but if you really look at the context and everything, that actually doesn't make a lot of sense. So either one, let's say more than half or all of the spiritual life, what did that actually mean? And I think that those two things together, the fact the Buddha refused to appoint a successor, and then this interchange, has led to a lot of misinterpretation. And just being candid, and this is my own opinion, I think that there's a lot of fuzzy thinking about what community means from a Buddhist perspective in some Buddhist communities. And I think it's part of the reason that a lot of small sanghas fail. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons that I'm going to talk about. The talk next week is going to be about how the Western model has adopted some of what I'm going to talk about tonight and has diverged from actually quite a bit of it, and what is being created here. It's basically an experiment. And how SIM specifically relates to that, and my thoughts about that. Okay, I'm trying to put SIM actually in kind of a historical context and the movement of the Dharma into the West. But so historically, what did community mean? And it means a couple of a number of specific things. The first thing that the Buddha says is it means that practitioners come together regularly to listen to the Dharma and to discuss the Dharma. And the important part for that, for me, is what is the Dharma? And the Dharma is his teachings and the three trainings and the Eightfold Path. And it is not simply personal choice that I have a series of preferences, so I'm going to take this part of the teachings that I like and I'm going to ignore that part of the teachings, which is different than I'm going to emphasize something and then I'm going to put something else on the back burner. Okay. The second thing is that those practitioners who are coming together are actually practicing it, and that they are attempting to embody the three trainings and the Eightfold Path in every aspect of their life. That there is an effort either in community or in this way that we are here to live together communally with the express purpose of trying to understand how conflict arises and how can we can be skillful in conflict with other people who are trying to embody the Dharma, and how we cultivate and develop fellowship and spiritual friendship. I mean, these are express purposes of what community is. That the community is founded on the Vinaya, the guidelines for conduct. And so in a lay context, there, you know, there's, of course, with Buddhism, you know, there's all these numbers, right? So there are the five lay precepts, there's the eight lay precepts, there's the 10 lay precepts, you know, for depending on where you are on your journey. And then there's the Vinaya for monks and nuns, which are 228 rules. And I would have difficulty with that. I even have trouble counting that high, much less remembering all of it. But and I'm going to talk a little bit about how that developed. Not initially, but subsequently, another feature of it was that the monastic community served the surrounding lay community by offering teachings and guidance. And the Buddha even gave very express teachings to monks who were traveling and were going out into the community about how to teach and what not to teach. You know, for example, some monks would, you know, one of the features of the teaching was to memorize suttas and then to recite them to show that you knew them and, you know, and then reflect on this. And so what some monks would do is that when they were asked to give some teachings, they would recite a sutta. And that was frowned upon because that was considered, you know, nothing more than reciting the sutta. It wasn't showing that you had a grasp of it and that you were actually adapting it to the needs of the particular audience. Okay? So. The next, there's only two more. But these are good, aren't they? I mean, these are really helpful to hear this. You know?
What happened to the other 200?
Excuse me?
What happened to the other 200?
Well, no, those are the ethical rules, which I'm going to recite in just a second.
All right!
Okay. So the next one kind of relates to the community, and that is that... And this goes to Donna, which I'm going to talk about later, but that all of the above, you know, the community and all the monks and nuns, are wholly dependent on the community that surrounds them. That it's very much like anicca, you know. Anicca is not just change, it's that what appears is dependent on what immediately precedes it and conditioned by, and so the relationship of the monastic community to the lay community is one of dependency. Okay? And then finally, and it may be obvious, but the most important one, is that you can have all the above, and from the Buddhist perspective, that would not be a Buddhist community. The last one is that the purpose of everything above is to help individual practitioners become awakened and for practitioners to support each other in becoming awakened, that the end game is awakening. And I think that's, for me, huge, because you see in the West that there's certainly been a tendency, I think it's coming back around now, but the teachers, Western teachers, not wanting to talk about awakening or enlightenment or whatever you want to call it. And I personally think that that's just such a huge mistake because of this. And I think you see a lot of communities where the predominating energy in the community is social, as opposed to oriented in this way. That's not to say there's anything wrong with social. I think it's critical, you know, as a community to come together and become friends and, you know, and all that. But if that's taking second place to the energy of all of us moving forward and all of us helping everybody else moving forward spiritually, then the community's off base from a historical perspective. And I think there's a huge message in that for today. Okay, so what is some of the features of the structure and operation of the community? And the first one is obvious, but I'm just going to mention it, and I've already said it in such a way, but that everything was based on the three trainings on the Eightfold Path. No exception to the rule. So, you know, the way issues would be framed to make decisions by the Sangha, in other words, the wisdom piece, right? Like, what is the framework for actually deciding what to do and how to do it? How do we relate to each other? How do we relate to the community outside? Everything. So the teachings are the hub of the wheel, and then intensively practicing in a monastic sense. You know, it was going on all day long in one feature or another. There was nothing that wasn't defined as practice. And then I'm going to break out the details of it. So from an organizational structure, and then I think this is helpful to hear, is that, you know, you have a community of a couple of thousand people. You know, think about this. You know, this is back in India before there's electricity and, you know, everything. And everybody's living with, you know, one robe, one bowl. And you've got to worry about health care, everything. Okay? A couple thousand nuns. So the first thing to realize is, while we're, most of us, are always talking about the Buddha. You know, the Buddha was surrounded by this extraordinary group of people. I mean, it's amazing. Like, if you take the time to study that, there was this unbelievable team of elders. And they were called elders not because necessarily because they were old. It was because of their practice. So, you know, you've got the Buddha, you've got Ananda, you've got Sariputta and Moggallanda. They'll always appear at the bottom of this particular tanka. Mahakasapa, who was, you know, a very big, there were two brothers, the Kasapa brothers, who had these huge followings. And they brought all of those people into the community. There were something like 700 people, these two brothers. So there's just this whole group of people that were surrounding the Buddha. And the Buddha designated 80 different categories of individuals, both monks and nuns, in terms of a particular person being at that moment in time having the most outstanding knowledge and experience in a particular quality. So, just to give you an idea, you know, I was looking at my print tonight, and at the rate I'm going, I think it's going to be like 26.5 print, you know, like I'll have like three lines per page. So that's what I'll be able to see. So, where did it go? I guess I got ahead of myself. Okay, so there would be like some of the categories were, and these were people who were designated, both monks and nuns, by the Buddha as the person who is the most outstanding in faith, wisdom, energy, working with energy, loving kindness, patience, equanimity. And so so then there were gradations in terms of who would teach and who would teach what. There were specializations within the community. And Sariputta and Moggallanda, these two, you know, their story is very interesting because they started off as very young men in their teens on a spiritual search. They both left home. They were both Brahmins, you know, at the top of the Indian society at the time. And for, I don't know, it's like 12, 15 years, they were on a spiritual search and eventually gave up and decided that there was nobody out there who knew the truth, you know. And they made a pact that they would keep watching. And if they heard of anyone that they thought was for real, that they would alert the other one and they would go check it out. And I won't give you the whole story. It's a fascinating story. But eventually, the Buddha came into town and they met a monk who was with the Buddha, and they talked with him, and then they went and saw the Buddha, and then they said, this is the real thing. And at age 40, they went into the community and then eventually became awakened, and then kind of became, you know, not joking, they kind of became the CEO and CFO of the Sangha. Because there was this whole organizational structure. I mean, separate and apart from the community, to run an organization that big, or just run an organization of several hundred people. You know, there were all kinds of positions and all kinds of jobs that had to be taken care of within the community. They were the two who were overseeing all of that, and then there was basically a whole organizational structure between below them that discharged all of this. So it was a team effort, you know, and you know, it had to be enormously well run for it to have survived and for it to have worked. And for me, the thing I asked here is that it was just implicit, where now we have to encourage people, it was just implicit that participation by everyone was essential to survival of the community. You didn't even have to talk about it. It's like, if I'm part of this community, part of my role is to participate and to help. I don't do that, the community doesn't exist, you know. So for me, that's one of the huge shifts, you know. Okay, so the guidelines for conduct and for relationships, we hear a lot about the Vinaya, which I'm going to mention in just a minute, but the thing that has really struck me in looking at the ethical rules of conduct and the way that the Buddha tried to develop conduct is his enormous stress on looking at both the roots of conflict and the roots of cooperation and fellowship in the community. And in fact, there are two suttas, there are parallel suttas about the roots of cordiality and the roots of conflict. And when we go on pilgrimage, it's one of the things we study before we go. And it's interesting because if you look at those two suttas, they're a little bit different than the other suttas. And the way to think of this, I think the easiest way to shortcut this explanation is there are some suttas where the Buddha says the equivalent of may. You know, you may do this or you may try this out. And, you know, it's implicit. It's sometime you need to try it out, but it's like may. And then there are some suttas where he says shall. It's like, this is so important, you need to do this. And these two suttas, that's what he's saying. And they have to do, the sutta on cordiality and fellowship has to do basically with metta and how we relate to each other, and always making a value of trying to do that, like all the time in community. And then the roots of dispute is really worth reading, because he outlines six specific things that are the roots of disputes and cause dissension. And so in communities who are devoted, I mean, like if in fact it's true that we form a community and the purpose of the community is to get awake and to help everybody else get awake, what's the biggest threat to that? Conflict and dissension undermines everything, you know? Petty resentments, which develop into dissension. And in fact, part of the Vinaya, you know, like part of the answer to the question of, well, why are these all these rules? 228 rules. You know, like, and then you read some of them and it's like, well, that sounds like a crazy. I mean, why were they drilling down that much? And part of the reason was it was in, you know, he and the other monks didn't sit down and one afternoon say, let's see, the Vinaya, the rules of ethical conduct. How many should there be? 180? No, that's not the number. 200? No, and then somebody says 228, and everybody goes, yeah, that's the number. Well, that's not what happened. What happened is that there was a gradual development. And for example, if you read the suttas, it's very, you know, the Buddha actually centers out in his suttas 37 different competing spiritual groups at the time. The one that he spends the most time on is the Jains. Okay? They still exist today. You know, they're more of a minor group, but they still exist. At the time, they were the big rival. It's clear that that's how he perceived it. When the leader of the Jains died, the leader had done the same thing as the Buddha. He had refused to designate his immediate successor. The difference was between that and what happened in the Buddhist case was that a structure wasn't in place as it was in the Buddhist community. And when he died, that community just started to fall apart almost immediately. There were power struggles going on. There were dissensions. There was no agreement on the Vinaya. They didn't have an equivalent Vinaya, like, well, what was ethical conduct? What wasn't ethical conduct? And it's very clear that whole parts of the Vinaya were written in direct response to what the Buddha and the elders saw happening in the Jains community. It's like, man, that is really dangerous, and we are not going to allow that to happen to us. So the Buddha maybe he's not designating somebody, but we can see what the origins are of a community falling apart when their leader dies. Okay. So this idea of conflict and dissension being such a threat to the community, and intentionally spreading, you know, like rumor, spreading a rumor, so trying to hurt somebody, that was considered a huge offense in the community, because it undermines somebody else's position in the community and it created dissension. And so there was a whole system about if you did something like that and got called on it, that there would be a kind of a hearing. Hearing is probably too formal, but in some of the big cases, I mean, depending on what it was before the entire sangha. Right? But there would be an examination of it. There was a value on people admitting that they had violated the Vinaya, and acknowledging the harm that it may have done to another person and the potential harm that it did to the entire community. And of equal stress was in the value of forgiveness and tolerance and patience with people. So it's not just, well, we're going to have a hearing, you know, I'm calling you out on your misbehavior, and because, you know, there was a whole range of sanctions. I mean, like monks and nuns were actually put on probation, you know, depending on what they did, and then they would be on probation for so long, and then they had to appear before a little council, you know, of 10 monks or nuns, talk about it, and then the 10 would say, okay, you know, you're off probation, you're back up. People were sanctioned, they were censured, some people were expelled, you know, like Devadatta, you know, who tried to kill the Buddha, and, you know, they called it the Gang of Five. Devadatta and these four other people, that he convinced that if they followed him, he was going to be the next Buddha, and, you know, that the whole Sangha was going to go with him and everything. Well, they all got all kicked out, you know. And it turns out he was wrong. So forgiveness was a very big deal. And the idea that, and I want to stress this, no matter what your violation, as long as you were able to face it and acknowledge it and be forgiven for it, provided you with the possibility of awakening. And the most dramatic example of that is Angulimala, which the whole story of Angulimala was basically a serial killer. And Angulimala means garland of fingers. So he was a serial killer. You'd take, you know, a finger and put it on, you know. And he eventually became awakened and was considered the patron saint of pregnant women. Yeah. That's what he was known for, you know. And even after awakening, you know, his story is a story about karma, because he awakens, and now he's an awakened being, right? And they go back into town, and some people would see him with the Buddha, and because he was with the Buddha, this is in Srivaste, where we go on pilgrimage, he'd go into this little town, and some people would see him, and because he was with the Buddha, they would give him a break and say, okay, you know, the Buddhists, we respect the Buddha so much that we'll take it for granted that he's awakened and treat him with respect. There were others that would see him, you know, that they knew about his killings, family members of, you know, that had lost a mother or a brother or a father or a daughter, and they'd basically say, we don't care if it's the Buddha or who says it, you know, we might kick this guy's butt. They'd throw tomatoes at him and beat him up and all kinds of stuff. And there's one sutta where Angulimala comes back to the Buddha and says, hey, I thought, you know, I'm awakened. I thought, like, things were supposed to be good. He says, I keep going into town and I keep getting my butt kicked. And the Buddha basically says, hey, we can, none of us can escape our karma. You know, for you to think that you could do that and we're going to pay a price in this life, you know, you can't live in this world and not be part of it, you know. So there's a range of sanctions, and then the last little part, and this is part of the Naya that for me is another issue, is decision making. And there's a rumor afoot that the way that decision making was made in the historical saga, historical community, was by consensus. Okay. So you have consensus being this premium idea within a lot of lay Buddhist communities. And that's half true. Okay. So in the historical community, the effort was made completely, good faith, sincere effort was made to reach consensus. If, however, a small group of people or a single person was basically holding the Sangha hostage, you know, because the idea of Sangha was, well, every single person has to agree, as opposed to not every single person has to agree, but they have to agree that it's in the best interest of the Sangha. You know, the essence being, and we have a thing that we do on our board where we actually read this, where in terms of making decisions as a SIM board member, we will act in the best interest of SIM, and we will not advance our personal agenda. And that's what true consensus means. I'm not, you know, I may have, like, I may want to do it different, but I'm not going to hold up the entire decision if it's the best thing for the community, okay? But what would happen in the historical community if that happened? You know, if somebody just said, no, I'm not going to agree, or this small group is going to agree, they would move to a vote on majority rule. They say, okay, you know, everybody agree? We've really tried. Yeah, okay. Majority rule. You know, raise, I don't know if they raised hands or said aye or nay or what they did, but somehow they did that. But I think that's significant to me, you know, because this is another area where you just see, in my opinion, a lot of groups really getting stuck of not understanding what consensus in a historical meaning actually means. And on the Vinaya, I think it's worth taking the time to read the Vinaya. Okay? And there's much of it that seems kind of archaic and why, but if you read the Vinaya, the rules, of the guidelines of conduct, with the idea that their purpose is to point the mind towards awakening and to create the conditions within a community where everybody's mind can go towards awakening, they start to make a lot of sense, because what they're doing is that they're taking away all of the grounds for dissension and conflict. Because where does dissension and conflict arise from? It arises from desire, aversion, delusion. Delusion basically arising from narcissism and identification with self. And so if you look at it that way, suddenly all these rules, as arcane as some of them may seem to us, suddenly make sense. Because you can see they're all pointing in that direction. And then if you just look at the outline, the categories that they fall in, listen to this. I think this is helpful. So of the 208 monastic rules, the categories, among others, are harmlessness, specific rules protecting us from harming each other, relationships, possessions and offerings from the community. If you talk about anybody who's ever been a monk, one of the edges is offerings from the community. Because particularly in Asia, you know, people, you know, just want merit so badly to help, that if you even make a glancing comment about your sandals or your robe, you'll have a new pair of sandals or a new robe the next day, you know. So this whole clothing, alms, food, medicines, valuables and money, lodging, right livelihood for a monk or nun. You know, you hear that as a division, and suddenly maybe they aren't so arcane, you know. So I've actually found it very, very profitable, not all at once, but to sit down and kind of work through them and ask myself, well, why would they do that particular thing? And then from a reasoned perspective, try to come up with an answer. And just that process has been very helpful for me. And in my own case, and I think if you try this, it'll be in your case too, it's made me really reflect. It's been a mirror for me about my own life. You know, because it goes through everything, right? Possessions, valuables, kind of food you're eating. I mean, boy, it's really relevant stuff. Okay, so the training of monks and nuns. The Buddha had an entire system set up. So there was one group of elders who would teach the novice monks and nuns. And then there was another group who would teach people after they had gotten through the novice stage and take them up to the, you know, there's traditionally four stages of awakening. So there was another group of nuns who would take you from when you were no longer a novice up through the first stage of awakening. And there was another group of elders who would take you through the second, third, and fourth stages. And then there were a whole group of people who specialized in, well, you know, this teacher is the metta teacher, and this teacher is the wisdom teacher, and this teacher is the, you know. So there were all these kind of like specialties. And each one of them would come in at a certain stage of training, and they would be the key person. And if you look at the suttas, you know, some of the most powerful and quoted suttas aren't by the historical Buddha. You know, you hear these quotations, and frequently they're not attributed to the person who actually did them. So like Moggallanda and Sariputta and Ananda, you know, all gave these spectacular suttas. And the Buddha would always endorse them. You know, there was this model that if anybody else gave a sutta, a teaching, people would go to the Buddha and say, you know, it's kind of, okay, hey, you know, like, Ananda just gave this talk, you know, over there under the tree, and he said X, you know, and what do you think? And the Buddha, and then there's this formulaic thing where the Buddha would just basically go, that guy knows what he's talking about. And then it was official. Okay? So, alright, so the training methods, and there's, I think, some little nuggets in here for us. So, one of the most common thing, and of course, at this point in time, there was an oral tradition because there was nothing, you know, there was no method of writing, right? Preserving this. So, the basic form, starting place, was listening, memorizing, reflecting on, and reciting teachings. Okay? And I think that we have, I think we still listen to teachings. But memorizing, reflecting upon, and reciting, I think is... You very seldom hear teachers talk about memorizing a sutta or a whole part of a sutta, much less kind of like reciting it, okay? But I know that Diane, in some of the affinity groups that she has, you know, she encourages people to, like, well, memorize the Metta Sutta or memorize this. And I can tell you that when you do that, it's extraordinary what you learn, because... as part of, I mean, just with the Metta Sutta, my experience with memorizing the Metta Sutta is you go through, and, you know, you go through this kind of thing, okay, well, okay, I forgot the word, but and then you get it down, and then you, well, I wonder why that word. You know, and I wonder why that idea preceded this idea. So then this automatically leads to reflection. So it's amazing how such a simple thing is so powerful. So I really encourage you to think about this. You know, I think we've lost something. And then the reflection piece as well, I think we've kind of lost. I mean, just, you know, reading a sutta or reading a Dharma book, you know, and reading a paragraph, and rather than, like, well, you know, rifling through 20 pages, I mean, like, Joseph Goldstein has come out with this book, Mindfulness. And I have trouble reading more than a couple of pages at a time. You know, it's so incredible stuff. I mean, it's not uncommon where I'll keep rereading two pages for a week and just reflecting on it. You know, just letting it cook, you know. And so, you know, I think there is so much Dharma material out now. And because of our culture, it's like, well, I've got to find the right thing. And the quality of quietly sitting with something and reflecting on it and looking at it from different angles, I think, to some degree, we've lost. And my understanding is that this was valued in the original format of teaching. So the next stage was that practitioners of equal kind of levels of development, equal rank, would study the Dharma and discuss it, that they would meet with senior teachers to discuss the Dharma and seek guiding. And then as they progressed in terms of their knowledge and skill and training, they would begin assuming the role of helping others, the ones before them. So, you know, clear recognition that we're not all equal in terms of our training, and you know, it's a gradual awakening, and so that the more senior people, as they move down the path, would assume certain roles, and then you would it was expected of you, in other words, to move into a role of helping the newer people behind you. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. And then the last part, and it was implicit in the model, is that there was a continuous effort to actually move further down on the path, so that there in that structure, there, you know, you were getting guidance of where you were on the path. And we don't have that feature really solidly put in place in most of the Western Dharma communities. It's like, you know, we're all kind of all practicing. And where we are in the path, and whether we're even on the path. You know, because you can do a lot of practicing and not be on the path. You know, I mean, that's the truth. You know, I mean, that's one of the insights, one of the growing insights of moving towards the first stage of awakening, is actually knowing if what you're doing is actually on the path or not. I mean, that's a fascinating marker. You know, if you think about that, you know, a little scary actually, you know. But the idea that there is a continuous effort to move forward, to grow, towards what? Towards the purpose. And what's the purpose? The purpose is moving towards awakening. Okay, I'm getting short. So I'm going to skip here. So I'm going to go to Donna. We all know what Donna is, right?
Yeah,
of course. I mean, we hear it all the time. I think if you look at the historical structure of the community and the relationship to between the surrounding community and the monastic community, and within the monastic community, you get a different understanding of what Sangha is of what Dana is. And for me, it's quite a profound idea, because it's what I said earlier, is that it's one of dependency, and it's one of total dependency. It's like, I don't eat today or this week unless someone provides me with food. I don't have sandals that don't have holes in them unless somebody provides me with sandals. I don't have a robe that's full of holes, a nice robe, not nice in the sense of it's glamorous, but that, you know, it's rags, but it's whole, unless someone stitches that together and gives it to me. Complete dependence. And if you think about this, this is such the Western definition that we're always putting out of Dana as meaning generosity. It is like a modest description of it is lukewarm. I mean, the true meaning of Dana, and the way that I hold this is, if you think about it, is it means I or we don't survive without you. I don't survive on my own. You know, and Thich Nhat Hanh, who, you know, as probably most of you know, is kind of in tough condition right now. He had a massive stroke, but he's still alive. You know, his effort to try to bring together, I believe, this idea and then the ideas of Anicca and Anatta was to coin a whole new term. And he called it inner being. I mean, like, the connection is so deep. That it's saying, I am inseparable. Because if you're not there for me, I no longer survive. You know, if we're not here for each other, the community doesn't survive. And this is, you know, like Namarupa. I mean, it's just, you know, mind and body, you know, is just a completely integrated whole. It's another form of integration. So I think, you know, you go to Asia, and I mean, we know that spiritual life was and still is in many places, in India, particularly in northern India, highly valued. And in Thailand and Cambodia and in Myanmar, Burma, you can feel it. And so in some way being associated with the spiritual search and spiritual awakening is something, just being associated with it and supporting it is something of value. It's something that is aspired to. It is a source of great cultural and individual pride. And I think it's a fair statement that that description is not something that we're seeing in the West. We're seeing it with some people, and with some, but as a general rule, that's not our understanding of either community or Dhamma. And I think there's reasons for that. I mean, you know, the kind of this obsessive individualism that we have in the West is a little bit different than the model in Asia. I mean, they have their own problems, you know, they have their own unique issues. And there's a lot of reasons for this, but I think understanding that this is the true meaning of Dhamma is highly informative, and it's highly informative about whether or not... See, my opinion is, and this is next week's speech, but my opinion is we haven't even gotten close in the West of addressing the actual core financial issues of having a spiritual community. In creating an environment where the community itself and teachers can actually teach and not have to have a day job, that they can devote themselves to the Dharma. There's very few people who are doing it, okay? I remember when John Travis, and I, you know, John started off as one of my core teachers, and then we became close friends, and we started teaching together, and so we just had this rich experience over 20 years. And I remember when John was considering moving to Dhamma. You know, and before that, he was a carpenter, and he had a little import business would bring things in from Asia. And I remember the discussions about this, and like how terrifying it was, because basically, you know, you're saying, okay, you know, like, here on out, who gets to determine, like, my financial life, what I, you know, how much money I have and don't have, whether I can pay for health insurance? Yeah, you do. You know? And so, you know, we're getting musical accompaniment for the idea. That was a nice touch, man. Wow. But, you know, think about that. Like in your head, I mean, how many of us would consider anything close to that? You know, maybe the closest that any of us can get to that is surviving on Medicare. But I mean, it's profound. I mean, for somebody to give their life over in that way, you know, and I mean, they literally are saying, you know, I don't survive without you. I don't survive without you. You know? We don't survive without you. This organization doesn't survive without you. You know? So, for me, this is really profound, profound stuff. And it's profound because I think we're in a great experiment here, and As great as what we're doing is, I think it's quite an open question of whether or not the Western model that we have is going to survive. If you go to the ethnic Buddhist churches, they all have a model set up to make sure that the leadership and the teachers and, you know, the roshis and who, you know, whatever they're called on the tradition are being supported and can retire and all these things. You know, we don't have anything like that. We don't have anything close to that. You know, we're still trying to figure it out. So many of us are seeking refuge in communities like this because we're trying to get away from religious institutions where we felt that they were always asking for money and like leaning on us for money and, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, we just have to figure this out if we want, if we value this and want to survive, really want this truly to survive. We have to figure it out. And I can tell you that personally, you know, that's my whole focus now. You know, I mean, now that I have this little grandson, it's just so clear to me that at my age, it's about the next generation. It's about the future. I mean, I'm not giving up on awakening. No. But I mean, there's much more here than our individual practices. There's the future. And I love the Dharma. I mean, I love the Dharma. It is the center of my life. And so I want to figure out with you how to make this survive. So okay, so we have those are my comments for tonight on the traditional foundations. And then next week, what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to try to challenging as this sounds, I'm going to try to trace the historical kind of the history of the Theravadan community from the historical Buddha all the way to Sacramento. Because I actually believe I can do that. I'm pretty clear, at least in my own mind. And I have been accused a lot of being deluded. But I think I can put something together that really makes sense, you know. And then I want to talk about the Western model, at least is how I perceive it, and what we're specifically trying to do with this particular model in a way that I hope is helpful. So we have a few minutes if there's questions or comments. See, you know what's going on right now. What they teach you in Dharma teacher school. There is no such thing. But they say, ask a question, and then just sit there. You know. Don't get uncomfortable. Let them get uncomfortable, and it'll get so uncomfortable that somebody will ask a question. But seriously, does anybody have any thoughts or comments or questions? Okay. So, thank you very much for coming. I just can't think of a more... Oh, okay. All right.
Plum Village, Pickup Commons community. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how big it is in terms of residents. Did he organize it to try to follow the example that you're talking about, categorization and structure?
I've never been to Plum Village, you know, and that's kind of a Zen practice, and so I don't know. I know several people who have practiced there for a period of time, I mean like years, mm-hmm. and what they've reported is that there is a very intact structure. It's very well thought out and self-supporting through. So I'm sure there is, but I can't describe it.
So perhaps with him sort of out of the picture, it will be able to continue on.
I'll bet that it does. It, you know, it, here's the problem. You know, anytime you have someone who is so charismatic, and fortunately, who is ethical, okay? You know, because we've had lots of problems. You know, and for some reason, nobody wants to talk about it. We've had all kinds of problems in Buddhist communities and the Vipassana community. Just no question about it. But, you know, there's always this thing that happens after a very charismatic person leaves, or either leaves or dies. And people become kind of addicted to the charisma, you know. And I know that, you know, it's extraordinary to be in his presence. So people show up and the experience isn't quite the same, you know, if, for those people who used to come and be around him. So you have some kind of falling off, you know. But I would bet anything that that community is a really, really healthy community and will survive and be a real influence in, you know, the entire Buddhist world. I mean, I would, knowing him and his teachings and what I've heard about the community, it'd be kind of shocking if that didn't happen.
You know, just looking at some of the notes that I took in here, and I think if we just reflected on what is the best interest of the Sangha, and I can't survive without you for a few days this week, I think it, you know, we might have some surprises for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give it a try.
Yeah, well, I support that. You know, I think that we've another thing that's happened is we've kind of gotten caught up in quantity. You know, we're like this topic, we could talk about this topic a lot, have a dialogue about it and everything. I mean, I think those two things, if we actually reflected on it, it would lead to something. Okay, so thank you very much for coming tonight. I can't think of more lovely thing to do than to spend an evening with a group of well-intentioned people who are interested in the Dharma. You know, I mean, we're awfully lucky. And in a world where there's so much suffering, may our efforts tonight in some real tangible way help alleviate the suffering of beings all around the globe. So thank you very much.
Thank you.